Chapter 11. Wretched and cursed his stars that he ever had married the butcher's daughter. It wanted 6 months of the time. A sudden and desperate resolution seemed all at once to have taken possession of Simon Gambouch. He called his family and his friends together. He gave one of the greatest feasts that ever was known in the city of Paris. He gaily presided at one end of his table, while Mrs. Gam, splendidly arrayed, gave herself airs at the other extremity. After dinner, using the customary formula, he called upon Diabolus to appear. The old lady screamed, and hoped he would not appear naked. The young ones tittered, and longed to see the monster. Everybody was pale with expectation and affright. A very quiet, gentlemanly man, neatly dressed in black, made his appearance, to the surprise of all present, and bowed all round to the company. "Will not show my credentials," he said, blushing, and pointing to his hoofs, which were cleverly hidden by his pumps and shoe buckles, "unless the ladies absolutely wish it. But I am the person you want, Mr. Gambouch. Pray tell me what is your will." "You know," said that gentleman, in a stately and determined voice, "that you are bound to me, according to our agreement, for 6 months to come." "I am," replied the newcomer. "You are to do all that I ask, whatsoever it may be, or you forfeit the bond which I gave you." "It is true." "You declare this before the present company?" "Upon my honor, as a gentleman," said Diabolus, bowing, and laying his hand upon his waistcoat. A whisper of applause ran round the room. All were charmed with the bland manners of the fascinating stranger. "My love," continued Gambouch, mildly addressing his lady, "will you be so polite as to step this way? You know I must go soon, and I am anxious, before this noble company, to make a provision for one who, in sickness as in health, in poverty as in riches, has been my truest and fondest companion." Gambouch mopped his eyes with his handkerchief. All the company did likewise. Diabolus sobbed audibly, and Mrs. Gambouch sidled up to her husband's side, and took him tenderly by the hand. "Iman," said she, "is it true? And do you really love your Griskinissa?" "Simon," continued solemnly, "come hither, Diabolus. You are bound to obey me in all things for the 6 months during which our contract has to run. Take, then, Griskinissa Gambouch, live alone with her for half a year, never leave her from morning till night, obey all her caprices, follow all her whims, and listen to all the abuse which falls from her infernal tongue. Do this, and I ask no more of you. I will deliver myself up at the appointed time. Not Lord G, when flogged by Lord B in the house, not Mr. Cartlidge, of Astley's amphitheater, in his most pathetic passages, could look more crestfallen, and howl more hideously, than Diabolus did now. Ache another year, Gambouch," screamed he, "two more, ten more, a century, roast me on Lawrence's gridiron, boil me in holy water, but don't ask that. Don't bid me live with Mrs. Gambouch." Simon smiled sternly. "Have said it," he cried. "Do this, or our contract is at an end." The devil, at this, grinned so horribly that every drop of beer in the house turned sour. He gnashed his teeth so frightfully that every person in the company well-nigh fainted with the cholic. He slapped down the great parchment upon the floor, trampled upon it madly, and lashed it with his hoofs and his tail. At last, spreading out a mighty pair of wings as wide as from here to Regent Street, he slapped Gambouch with his tail over one eye, and vanished, abruptly, through the keyhole. Gambouch screamed with pain and started up. "Ooh, drunken, lazy scoundrel," cried a shrill and well-known voice, "you have been asleep these 2 hours." And here he received another terrific box on the ear. It was too true, he had fallen asleep at his work, and the beautiful vision had been dispelled by the thumps of the tipsy Griskinissa. Nothing remained to corroborate his story, except the bladder of lake, and this was spurted all over his waistcoat and breeches. "I wish," said the poor fellow, rubbing his tingling cheeks, "that dreams were true," and he went to work again at his portrait. My last accounts of Gambo Jar, that he has left the yards, and is footman in a small family. Mrs. Gam takes in washing, and it is said that her continual dealings with soap suds and hot water have been the only things in life which have kept her from spontaneous combustion. Cartage. I have been much interested with an account of the exploits of Monsieur Louis Dominic Cartage, and as Newgate and the highways are so much the fashion with us in England, we may be allowed to look abroad for histories of a similar tendency. It is pleasant to find that virtue is cosmopolite, and may exist among wooden-shoed papists as well as honest Church of England men. Louis Dominic was born in a quarter of Paris called the Curtil, says the historian whose work lies before me, born in the Curtil, and in the year 1693. Another biographer asserts that he was born 2 years later, and in the Marais, of respectable parents, of course. Think of the talent that our two countries produced about this time. Marlborough, Villiers, Mandarin, Turpin, Boileau, Dryden, Swift, Addison, Molière, Racine, Jack Sheppard, and Louis Cartage, all famous within the same 20 years, and fighting, writing, robbing a levy. Well, Marlborough was no chicken when he began to show his genius. Swift was but a dull, idle, college lad. But if we read the histories of some other great men mentioned in the above list, I mean the thieves, especially, we shall find that they all commenced very early. They showed a passion for their art, as little Raffle did, or little Mozart, and the history of Cartage's knaveries begins almost with his breeches. Dominic's parents sent him to school at the College of Clermont, now Louis-le-Grand, and although it has never been discovered that the Jesuits, who directed that seminary, advanced him much in classical or theological knowledge, Cartage, in revenge, showed, by repeated instances, his own natural bent and genius, which no difficulties were strong enough to overcome. His first great action on record, although not successful in the end, and tinctured with the innocence of youth, is yet highly creditable to him. He made a general swoop of 120 nightcaps belonging to his companions, and disposed of them to his satisfaction. But as it was discovered that of all the youths in the College of Clermont, he only was the possessor of a cap to sleep in, suspicion, which, alas, was confirmed, immediately fell upon him. And by this little piece of youthful naivety, a scheme, prettily conceived and smartly performed, was rendered naught. Cartage, he had a wonderful love for good eating, and put all the apple women and cooks, who came to supply the students, under contribution. Not always, however, desirous of robbing these, he used to deal with them, occasionally, on honest principles of barter, that is, whenever he could get hold of his schoolfellows' knives, books, rulers, or playthings, which he used fairly, to exchange for tarts and gingerbread. It seemed as if the presiding genius of evil was determined to patronize this young man, for before he had been long at college, and soon after he had, with the greatest difficulty, escaped from the nightcap scrape, an opportunity occurred by which he was enabled to gratify both his propensities at once, and not only to steal, but to steal sweetmeats. It happened that the principal of the college received some pots of Narbonne honey, which came under the eyes of Cartage, and in which that young gentleman, as soon as ever he saw them, determined to put his fingers. The president of the college put aside his honey pots in an apartment within his own, to which, except by the one door which led into the room which his reverence usually occupied, there was no outlet. There was no chimney in the room, and the windows looked into the court, where there was a porter at night, and where crowds passed by day. What was Cartage to do? Have the honey he must. Over this chamber, which contained what his soul longed after, and over the president's rooms, there ran a set of unoccupied garrets, into which the dexterous Cartage penetrated. These were divided from the rooms below, according to the fashion of those days, by a set of large beams, which reached across the whole building, and across which rude planks were laid, which formed the ceiling of the lower story, and the floor of the upper. Some of these planks did young Carditch remove, and having descended by means of a rope, tied a couple of others to the neck of the honey pots, climbed back again, and drew up his prey in safety. He then cunningly fixed the planks again in their old places, and retired to gorge himself upon his booty. And now, see the punishment of avarice. Everybody knows that the brethren of the Order of Jesus are bound by a vow to have no more than a certain small sum of money in their possession. The principal of the College of Clermont had amassed a larger sum, in defiance of this rule. And where do you think the old gentleman had hidden it? In the honey pots. As Carditch dug his spoon into one of them, he brought out, besides a quantity of golden honey, a couple of golden louis, which, with 98 more of their fellows, were comfortably hidden in the pots. Little Dominic, who, before, had cut rather a poor figure among his fellow students, now appeared in as fine clothes as any of them could boast of, and when asked by his parents, on going home, how he came by them, said that a young nobleman of his schoolfellows had taken a violent fancy to him, and made him a present of a couple of his suits. Carditch the elder, good man, went to thank the young nobleman. But none such could be found, and young Carditch disdained to give any explanation of his manner of gaining the money. Here, again, we have to regret and remark the inadvertence of youth. Carditch lost 100 louis for what? For a pot of honey not worth a couple of shillings. Had he fished out the pieces and replaced the pots and the honey, he might have been safe and a respectable citizen all his life after. The principal would not have dared to confess the loss of his money, and did not, openly, but he vowed vengeance against the stealer of his sweetmeat, and a rigid search was made. Carditch, as usual, was fixed upon, and in the tick of his bed, lo, there were found a couple of empty honey pots. From this scrape there is no knowing how he would have escaped, had not the president himself been a little anxious to hush the matter up. And accordingly, young Carditch was made to disgorge the residue of his ill-gotten gold pieces, old Carditch made up the deficiency, and his son was allowed to remain unpunished until the next time. This, you may fancy, was not very long in coming, and though history has not made us acquainted with the exact crime which Louis Dominic next committed, it must have been a serious one, for Carditch, who had borne philosophically all the whippings and punishments which were administered to him at college, did not dare to face that one which his indignant father had in pickle for him. As he was coming home from school, on the first day after his crime, when he received permission to go abroad, one of his brothers, who was on the lookout for him, met him at a short distance from home, and told him what was in preparation, which so frightened this young thief that he declined returning home altogether, and set out upon the wide world, to shift for himself as he could. Undoubted as his genius was, he had not arrived at the full exercise of it, and his gains were by no means equal to his appetite. In whatever professions he tried, whether he joined the gypsies, which he did, whether he picked pockets on the Pont Neuf, which occupation history attributes to him, poor Carditch was always hungry. Hungry and ragged, he wandered from one place and profession to another, and regretted the honey pots at Clermont, and the comfortable soup and bouilli at home. Carditch he had an uncle, a kind man, who was a merchant, and had dealings at Rouen. One day, walking on the quays of that city, this gentleman saw a very miserable, dirty, starving lad, who had just made a pounce upon some bones and turnip peelings that had been flung out on the quay, and was eating them as greedily as if they had been turkeys and truffles. The worthy man examined the lad a little closer. Oh heavens! It was their runaway prodigal, it was little Louis Dominic. The merchant was touched by his case, and for getting the nightcaps, the honey pots, and the rags and dirt of little Louis, took him to his arms, and kissed and hugged him with the tenderest affection. Louis kissed and hugged too, and blubbered a great deal. He was very repentant, as a man often is when he is hungry, and he went home with his uncle, and his peace was made, and his mother got him new clothes, and filled his belly, and for a while Louis was as good a son as might be. But why attempt to balk the progress of genius? Louis was not to be kept down. He was 16 years of age by this time, a smart, lively young fellow, and, what is more, desperately enamored of a lovely washerwoman. To be successful in your love, as Louis knew, you must have something more than mere flames and sentiment. A washer, or any other woman, cannot live upon size only, but must have new gowns and caps, and a necklace every now and then, and a few handkerchiefs and silk stockings, and a treat into the country, or to the play. Now, how are all these things to be had without money? Cartich saw at once that it was impossible, and as his father would give him none, he was obliged to look for it elsewhere. He took to his old courses, and lifted a purse here, and a watch there, and found, moreover, an accommodating gentleman, who took the wares off his hands. This gentleman introduced him into a very select and agreeable society, in which Cartich's merit began speedily to be recognized, and in which he learned how pleasant it is in life to have friends to assist one, and how much may be done by a proper division of labor. M. Cartich, in fact, formed part of a regular company or gang of gentlemen, who were associated together for the purpose of making war on the public and the law. Cartich, he had a lovely young sister, who was to be married to a rich young gentleman from the provinces. As is the fashion in France, the parents had arranged the match among themselves, and the young people had never met until just before the time appointed for the marriage, when the bridegroom came up to Paris with his title deeds, and settlements, and money. Now there can hardly be found in history a finer instance of devotion than Cartich now exhibited. He went to his captain, explained the matter to him, and actually, for the good of his country, as it were the thieves might be called his country, sacrificed his sister's husband's property. Informations were taken, the house of the bridegroom was reconnoitered, and, one night, Cartich, in company with some chosen friends, made his first visit to the house of his brother-in-law. All the people were gone to bed, and, doubtless, for fear of disturbing the porter, Cartich and his companions spared him the trouble of opening the door by ascending quietly at the window. They arrived at the room where the bridegroom kept his great chest and set industriously to work, filing and picking the locks which defended the treasure. The bridegroom slept in the next room, but however tenderly Cartich and his workmen handled their tools, from fear of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.